Okay, thank you, Massimo. I would like to start with very thanks to the organizer for putting together this really beautiful conference, and I'm really honored to be a part of it. So I'm going to tell you about some work we've done on photolysis of the brackish larva. Just let me introduce just a little bit Laboratoire Jean Perrin. I'm pretty sure very few of you know about this lab. So it's a lab that's been created about 6 years ago by certain colleagues. We are all physicists interested in biological systems, biotechs. And the lab is located in this large campus, which is the biggest scientific campus in France, I think. Which, I mean, there have been discussions about the architecture. It's getting better. The nice thing is it's nicely located here. So it's getting rare to have such a large campus in such a crowded and nice city. So anyway, you're very welcome to come. We are located right here, and we actually belong both to the biology department, which is right here, and the physics department. So we are really trying to develop experimental computational approach inspired by physics and to apply that to various biological systems. So the first time I got interested in neuroscience was probably 10, 12 years ago. And at that time, I was working on a very boring mechanical problems, which is the friction between two surfaces. So you take two objects, you rub one against the other, and you look at all the forces are distributed. So it's a very, very long, I mean, there's a long history, dates back from Da Vinci, to understand how the force develops when two objects rub one against the other. And I came to realize at some point that we as humans were able to distinguish very tiny little difference in texture of the surface. And so we tried to understand that, and our approach was sort of biomimetic approach in which we designed some sort of artificial skin, just a layer of elastomer, and we put some macro force sensor at the bottom. And then we recorded the force when we rub a texture surface on top of it. And so we did that for a skin that's completely thin, completely smooth, and for a skin that displays this sort of corrugation that you have at the tip of your fingers. And we found out that the fingertip was creating this large fluctuation in the force detected a few millimeters below the skin surface. And so we proposed that this fluctuation actually could be detected by some specific mechanoreceptors in the skin, and that may actually explain why we have such a nice sensitivity to texture. After that, I came to work on a different system, which is the mammal system, sorry, the rodent system, and these animals detect texture also with a very fine sensitivity. But to do that, they don't use the same approach. What they do is they rub their long whiskers on these rough surfaces. And when you look at the signal that they can capture here, you see the same sort of oscillations. But in that case, this comes from the fact that these long, slender whiskers have some very strong resonant property. And so what you do is by rubbing this object, you excite these resonant frequencies, and so you recover this sort of oscillations. So you see that was for me striking that you have two systems. They share some sort of mechanoreceptors, but they have completely different tactile appendages, and still they were able to produce the same sort of signals at the level of the receptors. And we think that these fluctuating signals might explain why these two animals actually are able to detect such fine textures. Okay, so that was nice. I mean, I was excited to work on that. We worked with different neuroscientist colleagues, but I got frustrated by the fact that this is really hard to actually record in a real system the activity of neurons. So I was looking for a system in which a physicist like me would be able to, with not spending 10 years, be able to actually record neuronal activity. And so I came across these animals, this zebrafish larvae, which was getting traction at that time in the neuroscience community. And the reason why I picked this one is because it has a certain number of properties, and particularly the fact that you have fully transparent strains, like the Cato strain, for instance. It has a very compact and small brain of the order of 100,000 neurons. You can express calcium indicators because you have all these genetic tools that's been developed. And you have a pretty large behavioral repertoire that you can use to study. Okay, so in 2012, for instance, the Engels lab showed that they could record the entire activity of the brain of this animal. But to do that, they were using confocal microscopy, and so they had to actually do that many, many times on different animals and then fuse and stitch this different activity pattern in order to produce that. The reason why they had to do that is because the technique that they were using to do microscopy was relatively slow, and so to access these 100,000 neurons, they have to do that again and again and again. Okay, but at the same time, there was this new, or maybe not really new, but people were sort of rediscovering this technique of fluorescence microscopy, which we call light sheet microscopy. And they were producing this nice 3D or four-dimension movies in which you could look at the development of a small embryos for typically 24 hours. And they were able to follow and track each individual cells during this process. So just a couple slides to explain to you why light sheet microscopy might be really useful in certain systems compared to confocal or light sheet or two-photon microscopy. So the standard way to do volumetric fluorescent imaging is to use either confocal or two-photon microscopy. And these two techniques share one common aspect, is that they are point scanning methods. What do I mean by point scanning? It means that if you want to produce a complete image of within the sample here, what you have to do is to move a focus beam across the entire embryo. So you do point by point, and at the end, you get the whole image. And that comes from the specific way with which you define you do what we call optical sectioning. So that's how you actually produce this image. And this comes at a cost. The first cost is the fact that if you want to acquire n pixels at a certain acquisition rate f, this defines the time at which you're going to spend in each point. And this time is constrained by the fact that you need to wait enough time to get enough photons, enough fluorescent photon in your detector. So that is a strong constraint of the acquisition rate. And so typically what you can do is probably a few hundreds to 1,000 points at a time, right? And the second aspect is that if you want now to do a 3D image, you're going to have to move this plane at different positions. But each time you image one plane, actually you illuminate the entire sample, right? So each...
That's not true for two photons.
You still get the infrared light going through all of it, but you're right. If the effect that you're trying to avoid is the two-photon effect, then that is not true. You're still gonna illuminate a lot of infrared light through the sample, and so of course that means that the photonic efficiency is pretty low. It actually goes like one over the number of slices that you illuminate. Now, light sheet microscopy. The principle of light sheet microscopy is that you're gonna do the sectional optical sectioning by just shining a thin sheet of light across, and then you can parallel the acquisition. You can just put a camera and look at all the pixels together. So now your reaction becomes this one, right? And so you gain typically two order of magnitudes in terms of data throughput. And of course, the other aspect is that when you try to image one plane, you don't eliminate the rest of the sample. So the photonic efficiency is actually maximum. So you can go faster, and you can go longer, because you don't expose the sample to so much illumination. Okay, so now if you combine the two, this technique with the assess of the zebrafish, you can get easily this sort of image that we got in 2012. where here you see one single layer of the entire fish from the tenocephalon to the spinal cord. And you see that you can record the activity of, in that case, of the order of 5,000 neurons at 20 hertz. Okay, and now you can zoom in certain region of the brain. And of course, because you have so many of them, we do segmentation automatically. And then you can, for instance, record these neurons, and you see the typical burst of fluorescent activity associated with the activation of these specific neurons. So you can do that automatically on the different neurons, and so you get this very large raster plots where you can actually record simultaneously, you know, the visual, for instance, the optic tectum here, the hindbrain here, the spinal cord here, and the activity in the tenocephalon at the same time, which turns to be important also because then you can look at correlation between this pattern of activity.
This is in one plane right now.
This is one plane. So, of course, because this is one plane at 20 hertz. So because the custom reporter is pretty slow, you can actually use this speed to go in different planes sequentially. So what you're going to do is you're going to move both the light sheet and the objective sequentially. And for instance, in that case, we call five different planes at 4 hertz, so you just split this amount of information in different planes. And so eventually what you produce is this kind of, you know, large scales activity. And of course, if you go through the entire animals, you can see the activity all across the animals with a resolution that's pretty good. So let me maybe tell you what we do. You might hear everywhere that you do whole brain at single cell resolution. I will be more prudent because, you know, the cells are very compact. So I think what we can get is quasi whole brain recording because you're losing some part of the brain, for instance, in between the eyes, and sometimes also the reporter might not be expressed everywhere. And I don't think we are at single cell resolution because the neurons are so close. You may have some sort of crosstalk between very neighboring neurons. Also, the resolution, the temporal resolution, is pretty slow, and it's actually defined by the calcium reporter, so it's still of the order of 1 second.
So you probably explained, but I forgot. So these are juveniles.
Yeah. So these.
How big are these little fishes at this stage? How do you mount them?
So I'm going to show you how we mount them. So. I should put the scale. This is like typically 500 microns, and this is 2 millimeters. And we can do that up to 12 days. After that, you're losing the transparency. So we typically work around six dp, 6 days post-fertilization.
So I was wondering, in the recording like that, when we've played with it as well, you see that a lot of the large signals come from the ovaries if you have a cytoplasmic decamp, you know?
Yeah.
So how do you derive it? Do you actually pick out all the neurobiotic signals and just look for the donuts in your data, or?
Oh, yeah, I think in this one, you can do both. So we can, during the segmentation, we can get rid of the neuropiles. Sometimes we also sort of make little region of neuropiles because then we get the activities, just more information. But you can with the segmentation get rid of that if you wish to only look at some.
And when you reconstruct, did you ever manage to get a full like reconstruction, including the neurobile and the soma that they were coming from, the signals, or could you ever?
Oh, no, we don't see the projection. So you.
But you can follow them in Z, right? Like if you were.
Sometimes you see activity that goes from one soma and you see some projection, but you can do that. You can't do that systematically because it's just the spatial resolution is not good enough to do that.
But to be exact, though, it's not the getting rid of the neuropilic contamination, not just simply a matter of segmentation, because you can have overlaps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're right.
The pixel can have a mixture of multiple sources and so on. So
that comes with the idea that we're not single cell. So now you have lines where the expression is confined to the nucleus, and so in that case you completely get rid of that. But Yeah, you're right. In this situation, I think that's part of the thing that we need to be careful about. Okay, so this is how the fish is mounted typically. So it's mounted in some low melting agarose here that you can barely see. It's extruded from a small tube so that there's no optical problem associated with that. And so over the years, we've tested different stimuli. We used acoustic stimuli, temperature, light. So just one thing about the illumination, the visual stimulus is a little more tricky because we use blue light typically to do Tcam imaging. And that tends to interfere with the eye. So what we develop also is a two-photon version of this light sheet system, because in two-photon you use infrared, and so the animal is completely blind to this wavelength. And we also tried chemical stimulation. So this is one example of the sort of mapping that you can do. In that case, we send to the fish a pulse of hot or cold water, and we can reconstruct, and that's average over several fish, we can reconstruct the pattern of activity associated with each stimuli.
Sorry, I missed something. You said two-photon of, what did you do with two-photon?
Oh, so you just replace the blue laser with a pulse infrared laser, and so you can do two-photon light chain imaging.
Do you have enough energy in two-photon to stimulate whole sheet?
Yeah. You lose a little bit of signal to noise, and you can't go as fast. But we can still do something that's pretty similar. It's just that the spread over a larger distance and it's less focused. So actually, we use a lot of power, but we showed that it's feasible.
It's what's the frame rate?
In two photon?
Yeah.
So we can go up to 20 hertz frame rate, which was what we do with GCAM 3. Now with GCAM 6, you can go to 100 hertz in one photo. So we're losing, to maintain the signal-to-noise ratio, we're losing a bit of the frame rate.
It's not a point of even frame rate, but two photon, to get enough two photons in one spot, you need to focus the light.
Yeah.
You have a sheet, you have a humongous, are you using?
No, because the thing is, in two photon standard, you spend so little time at each spot that to get the same. Here in light sheet, you increase the duration of
the exposure. Is this like a low rep rate laser? Is this like a low rep rate, like kilohertz?
No. Huh?
No, the duration of you don't increase the number of photons simultaneously if you stay longer.
People have done two photon light sheet, like the temporal focusing and stuff, but I've seen like 4 hertz.
No, I mean, they've done it on, standard. I know it seems,
okay, I'm really surprised.
You presumably don't do a sheet, you use raster line.
Yeah, you raster line. You raster line.
Oh,
sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, actually, we raster line. Which, yeah.
You don't do it.
Okay,
Yeah. It's actually the same in one photon because it the image gets better than with the okay. So just sorry. Whoops. So I just want to advertise this. I'm not going to talk about that, but this is something recent that's been done by my colleague Volker Bommes, with whom we work, and he works next door. And he wanted to address another sensory system, which is the vestibular system. I don't know if some of you guys saw David Chopik talk 2 weeks ago. And so he did this crazy thing of mounting the entire setup on a rotating microscope. If I can start that. Just on it. Okay. So now the whole light sheet microscope is mounted on this thing, right? And so you can see, and so the fish is rolling back and forth like that. So you can see that it compensates with the eye movements, and it can actually record the entire brain activity when the fish is submitted to a vestibular stimulation. So this is something that's in BioArchive right now, and I think it's pretty amazing that he could do that. Okay, so this is, I'm not going to talk to you about that. So I want today to show you, how this technique can help us understand some complex sensory motor processes, and I'm going to be interested in the, in this process that the animal do, which is phototaxis. So this is stolen from Berger's lab, and you see when you have the number of larvae in a petri dish and you turn the light on somewhere, the fish tend to gather towards the light source. And so what I'm going to tell you are essentially two stories. The second one is published, and it's going to be in reverse chronological order. So the second one is published. The first one are pretty recent data that we got in the last year. And I think we should have started with that, but you know, we started with the imaging, and then we realized that we really need to understand the behavior aspect of phototaxis. So so we've heard in the last weeks that when simple animals are moving and navigating in sensory gradients, there are essentially two sort of strategy that they can use. One strategy is to use two different receptors and to compare left and right? And by doing this comparison, they can infer the direction of the source. So I'm going to call that stereovisual comparison. You can call that clinotaxis, I guess. Another possibility for an animal that, for instance, will have only one receptors or animals such that the gradient is so low at the scale of the animal that it can feel the gradient directly. One other strategy is to move during time, and then to compare what happened, to look at the difference in the stimulation cues that he experienced before and after he moved, right? And that I would call spatial temporal sampling or tropotaxis. So we were interested in knowing if, you know, all these two strategies are implemented in the animal. And to do that, we design experiments in which first we're going to address separately the left and right EMI field of the animal. So the fish has the capacity to form image in its retina, but we don't want that to be to influence the navigation of the animal. So we are going to present the animals with only some illumination on the left, some illumination on the right. So just two scatters, right? And what we're going to do is we're going to let the animal navigate and track the animal, and then stimulate the left and right EMI field in a controlled way that's going to be locked on the orientation of the animal. So what we're looking really at is the orientation of the phototaxis, how the animal orients toward the light source. Okay, so we're going to do two experiments to separate these two effects. In one experiment, we are going to only control the contrast between the left and the right eyes. So we're going to maintain the sum of the two intensity constant, but what we're going to change is the difference between the left and the right, and this is going to be adjusted depending on the angle of the animal. And in the second experiment, we're going to apply a whole field illumination. That means there's no contrast, no spatial cue given to the animal, but we're going to change the intensity of this whole field illumination depending on the angle of the animal. Okay, so by doing that, we can separately probe the two type of strategies. Okay, but before doing that, I'm going to look at the activity or the navigation of the animal without any cue. So in that case, the animal, the light is constant, uniform, and if you track the animal, and this arrow shows the direction and position of the animal. Something that's very striking is the fact that the animal moves by discrete bouts, and it produces one every 1 to 2 seconds, and between each bout, essentially, it does nothing. So the bouts last for 100 to 200 milliseconds, and then for 1 second, it essentially does nothing. So that means that we can probably simplify the problem by saying that the original trajectory, which is how this angle evolved this time, is discrete. And so the visual signal, because we lock the signal on the angular, the visual signal will be discrete also. So instead of using the time, we're gonna use n as the number of bouts that have been performed, right?
So are they only reorienting at the beginning of the bout as they burst, as they start to work?
Yeah, so what they do is they reorient, move forward. Okay. Or they just move forward. Okay. And then they stop for 1 second, and then reorient, move forward. Right. So we're going to consider only the variable as the number of bouts and not as time, really. And then what we want to do is to get this probability distribution function, which is, can we predict the distribution of this angle for the next bout, knowing the history of the navigation and the history of the signal, the visual signal that's been displayed to the animal. Okay, so if we just look at the spontaneous activity, the dynamics of the fish without this specific stimulation, the first thing that we see is that if I look at the distribution of these reorientation angles, I clearly have two distributions, one again the other. So this is shown in Somilog. So there's like two Gaussian distributed reorientation angles that I'm going to define as forward for the very thin distribution and turning. In other words, what I can sort of model is to say that at each time step, the animal decides if he wants to go straight, and so it's going to pick a value in these very small distributed angles, or if he wants to turn, and in that case, it's going to pick in this second distribution. Right? That's the first choice he has to do. But in fact, it's a little bit more complicated, because now if I look at the autocorrelation of dx, so this reorientation angle, what I see is that it's not a pure Markov process. In other words, there is some the autocorrelation doesn't go down to zero immediately, so there's some sort of memory of the last bout, and it tends to, if it turns left at one time, then the next turn has a large chance of turning left. And so by fitting that, we can actually compute this probability, and what we see is that if the animal turns left, then at the next bout, if he turns, then there's 80% of chance that he still turns left, right? So now we can produce this sort of kinematic. So the animal is here. The first thing he has to decide is, do I turn or do I go forward? And if I turn, do I flip? Do I change direction? Or do I lock? Do I stay in the same direction? And Q flip is going to be 0.2. So that means something.
Excuse me. How precise is the mapping from looking at the whole animal to this single angular variable? So for instance, the 0.1 radian width, is that he actually wiggles a little by 0.1 radian, or is it that it's hard for, is that in reducing the image of the whole larva to an arrow, you have a 0.1 radian error?
I think the resolution that we have is of the order of 1 to 2 degrees. And so 0.1 is probably 6 degrees. So you're right, there's a little bit of that. Actually, you're going to see, I think this forward swim are really straight. Like, I think this noise, essentially, you cannot perturb this width in any way. So when they go straight, I think this 6 degrees fluctuation, a little bit of it is because our measurement. But essentially, it's because the animal doesn't you know, cannot really go very, very straight. But in any way, it doesn't really matter because it's never going to change. The turning distribution might change, but the forward distribution never changes.
Is there any kind of visual cue that lets them know that they're going straight, or is it in the dark?
No, so it's not in the dark. In the dark, the animals tend to not do anything. So there's like a constant illumination, so they can see the bottom of the plate. So they can see, and they have, you know, this optomotor response, so they can see the flux. So yeah, they have this sort of information. Okay, so I just want to point that the fact that it has this sort of memory means that we can imagine that there is some sort of motor state, some motor memory in the brain that is maintained for typically 4 or 5 bouts, and which is going to switch from left to right in a pretty random way with certain probability. So we have to to understand this spontaneous activity, we have to take into account the fact that the animal has some sort of at least one bout memory, because it has to remember the direction of the last turning bout. Okay, so now let's start with the contrast modulation. So what we're going to do is, depending on the angle of the animal, from 0 to 2 pi, we're going to present to the left and to the right different intensity, right? So again, the total intensity is going to be constant, just the contrast is going to be modulated. So if the animal wants to go towards the light source, what he has to do is to reach this point in which the intensity is the same on the left and the right. So this is the stable point, because there's also a situation in which it will be the light source will be in the back, but in that case, instable, because if it turns a little bit, then it gets more light here, and then it's going to go there, right? Whereas when it's pointing toward the source, any modulation is going to, if it turns a little bit, there's more light to the left, and so this is going to bring it back to the center. Okay, so this is an example with one fish, many different. So the fish navigates in a petri dish. As soon as it gets too close to the wall, we stop it, bring the fish back, and do that again. So we have many, many different trajectories. I think this is like 65 trajectories. And so we start somewhere here, and you see the fish tense. It's not a very strong effect, as you could have seen in other species. I mean, the animal wants to go to the light, but it's not a very deterministic motion. Okay, and now if we look at the distribution of the orientation in this region, so which corresponds to, you know, how long it took for him to actually reorient, we can see that we have quite a significant bias towards the light source.
Would you clarify the pictures you have
here?
Yeah. Does this mean a light?
Yeah.
In response also to
the exactly. Fish? So suppose the fish points into that direction. So that direction corresponds to a certain angle here. And so I'm going to have this closed loop experiments in which I'm going to project to the fish in this reference frame. I'm going to project this intensity on the right and this intensity on the left. Now, if the fish turns, it's somewhere here now, and so I'm going to project this intensity to the right and this intensity to the left. And so I do that.
So, as far as the fish is concerned, the emotion does not change the illumination.
Oh yeah, it does.
It does.
Only if the fish turns does the stimulus change.
Relative to the fish itself.
Yeah. So it's really, I mean, it's a situation in which, so you have more light here and then here.
Yeah.
If I turn, then I see less light here and more here, for instance. So each time it turns, it has a new pattern. And this is supposed to simulate a situation in which there will be one light, one source here, and the only...
A point source.
A distant source.
Distant source.
Yeah. There was another question. Okay.
And the skew to the right, it's statistical
properly. Yeah, it's just not enough fish, I think. Okay, so now what we can do is just directly look at this probability of turning. So what you can do is compute the average drift of velocity of the fish, which means that you take all the fish at a certain contrast, that experience a certain contrast, and you look at what is the mean of the next bout. What is the mean reorientation of the next bout, which is the average of dx. So what you see is that if there is a contrast with more light to the left, then the fish has, in average, more chance to go to the left. If there is more light to the right, the fish has more chance to go to the right. And you have some sort of most linear relationship between contrast and this average drift. Okay, so what we saw is that, in fact, this change in the distribution doesn't come from the forward motion. So the mean of the forward distribution here essentially isn't changed across the contrast. But what really changed is the distribution of the turning bouts. So what happened is that if you have more light to a certain direction, then you just shift the distribution, you bias the distribution towards the right, and vice versa. Okay, so just to conclude on this part, there's the left-right contrast by the ratio of left versus right turns, but it doesn't affect the ratio of forward versus turning bots. So we can also compute the integral of these two distributions, and they stay exactly the same. In other words, if the animal, the probability that the animal goes forward or turn is unchanged by this contrast. The only thing that changed is the skewness of these distributions. Okay, so now let's go to the second part, in which we modulate the total intensity. So in that case, we're going to try different profile. So again, this corresponds to zero, it's a certain angle, pi is an angle, so it's symmetric between zero and because the other way around. And so at each angular position of the fish, we're going to deliver a certain intensity that's fixed by these lookup tables here. And so we ran a certain number of experiments. And in fact, in each of these situations, the animals tends to orient, statistically orient, towards the region where the light is maximum. So it seems to be able to do this artificial phototaxy in these two regimes. Now it's a little bit more complicated, because in that case, the animal, in order to reorient, it has to take into account what happened before. And before means the bout before he actually is going to make a decision. So in the bout before, the animal have made a certain turn, and this involved a certain intensity here, and a certain change in intensity associated with this bout. And now what we understand is to understand how this new turn depends on these variables that the animal recorded on the turn before, right? So the first thing we looked at is the possibility that the animal actually remember which way to go. Like, is it directed bias? Like, does it take the good choice of going to the source? And this could be possible. Like, you could imagine that the animal turns a certain direction, it sees more light, say, okay, there's more light, I should keep going. Now, if it turns to the dark, and you say, oh, I get less dark, I should turn around. And it doesn't seem to do that. So we don't see any directed reorientation. In other words, the animal doesn't seem to bias its next bout with respect to what it experienced in the previous one. So what it does, in fact, essentially, is it's going to change the probability of turning and the width of this distribution. So what's going to happen is that depending on this parameter, which we found was the good parameter, which is the relative change in intensity, and this is interesting because I think we've seen that in different talks, the good parameter is probably related to the Weber law, is the change, the relative change in intensity. As soon as the change in intensity is negative, then the animal is going to increase the probability of turning and deplete the probability of going forward. So what it's going to do is going to diffuse more, in a way, right? It's going to try to escape this region of low intensity by just turning more. And when it gets here, when the light goes up, it just does exactly what it would do if there was no stimulation. And that will also produce some sort of orientation towards the source. Okay, so no direct bias towards the source, a decrease in animation, increase the probability to turn, and the amplitude of the turns. These are the two effects combined that produce this curve here.
They, for instance, run faster after people are on?
Yeah, so I won't show that. We have data for the forward motion, so it's a different story. And they tend also to modulate that, and they also modulate the time between bouts.
So in the temporal case you just showed us, when they take an action and then you change the degree of light, the overall degree of light that they see, when does that change in light happen? Does it happen right after they just moved, or does it happen? Because you said they're staying still for about one second, was that right?
Yeah. So our setup, we do the closed loop simulation at 60 Hertz, so every 15 milliseconds, something like that. So they turn in a few milliseconds. So essentially, it's instantaneous for them. And once they've turned, they basically go straight.
Okay, so they're getting that feedback immediately.
Immediately. Yeah. I mean, we think that it's immediately compared to whatever they can detect. So,
right, which is probably 15 to 30 milliseconds.
Yeah.
Georges, did you ever check, it's a little bit of a crazy idea, but did you ever check the blind fish because they have deep upsins and they swim spontaneously as well? And I wonder if blind fish would show a modulation with ambient light as well.
We need to try that. It's exactly what we need, because it's possible that this second part might not use the eyes, or actually they might be able to do it without the eyes. This is definitely something we have
to do. Because they have a lot of brain upsins in the brain. Right?
Yeah, I know. And definitely that could be done without the need for retina.
So I didn't understand, what is the integration time? Like, what do you think is a critical time for integration?
So we don't have, I think we need to run different sort of data. Right now the problem is the reorientation is created with the change in illumination. So we can understand it by saying that it only remembers the last bot. It will be interesting to see if the bot before, how long does this memory kernel expand? And for the data we have, we cannot extract that. We can see that it depends on the first bots. It's not, we don't have enough statistics to show or exclude the fact that it might actually use the bot before.
I thought you were showing us with the autoregressive model that you fit that there is a memory that...
Yeah, but the autoregressive can be explained with a first order autoregression. Yeah. So again, it fits well enough and so that's enough. So essentially, to conclude, the idea is that, okay, the animal first has to decide between turn and not turn, and this can be modulated by uniform light change, or field light change. And then if he decides to turn, then he has to decide to flip or not to flip, and that also, the right and left, can be biased by the contrast. So you seem to have this like two parallel pathways that impact very different parameters that the fish use. Okay, so we'll just show you that we can, of course, implement this strategy by running some sort of Monte Carlo simulation. So we just use the empirical law that I've shown you and show that we can reproduce the sort of distribution that we get. I mean, I wouldn't claim that this is a demonstration, that this is the only thing, but that means that if you just take this very simple rule, you get something that's pretty close to what you actually observe. So it's probably capture most of the strategy of the fish. Okay, so one important thing to notice is that you have this left-right state. The animal seems to remember which way it was going, and it goes from left to right. And now if I shine light on the right, clearly you increase the probability of staying in the right state, right? So we're wondering, do we have a proxy for that? Do we have something where we could read out directly the motor state, the left-right motor state of the fish? So one thing that we noticed in these experiments in which we tether the fish, but we leave the eyes free and the tail free, something we noticed is that there's a strong coordination between the eyes and the tail. So this is shown here. If the animal looks to the left here, to the right here, so if the eyes are pointing to the right, then there is a very, very large chance that the animal will swim to the right. Right? And that corresponds in us to the coordination between the eyes and head. If you turn the eyes to the left, it's very rare that you're actually going to turn the head to the right at the same time. And in fact, there's also a strong temporal correlation. If there's a cycle here, there's a strong possibility that the animal is going to be. So if it turns the eyes to the left, it's going to try to actually turn his body to the left. So we thought that could be interesting because the eyes might actually give us some sort of behavioral readout of the motor state. So if I just focus on the eyes, you see it has this very regular cycads. That might be actually a little bit specific to the fact that the animal is fixed. So, but what you see is that the gaze, which is just the average of the two eyes, go from left to right, from left to right, and if you look at the distribution, you really have this like binary. You get the thing that you really have these binary behaviors, where the ice is on either way or the other way. And now, if I look at the distribution of the timescales between this transition, you get something of the order of 10 seconds, which is, you know, five, six bars. So it sort of corresponds to the sort of memory that I was showing you in terms of turning to the left or turning to the right. So we figured maybe, you know, the best way to understand and to look from null point of view at this brain left-right state would just be to figure out which circuit control this alternation between left saccades and right saccades.
So you said that it's just for a few bouts, but can you actually decouple? Because during the bout, they may behave very differently.
Yeah.
So it's just very different.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of it's a big bet. So maybe the thing you can see here in this movie is that the animal produce a very small number of tail bouts, typically one every 10 seconds instead of one every 1.5 seconds. So this is something that's due to the fact that the animal is tethered. And this is an issue that everybody has had, because I think that's a big difficulty when you want to do, for instance, virtual reality. And so the bet is the fact that this correlation is so strong, we hope that this oscillation of the tails of the eyes are still represented by the same oscillator that will drive in the natural setting the animal turning right or turning left. I'm with you. It's not a. We cannot really demonstrate that, because unfortunately we cannot have these animals producing enough tail boosts which would be comparable to the first primary swimming animal.
You have enough resolution and 3D moving animals to see the geese.
Yeah, I mean, not us, because that was really not the point. So we have a large. People have done that, like try to distinguish and discretize all the different bouts. In our case, we don't really care too much about the gates. I mean, the only thing that we want to know if it's going to turn left or right. So it might. I mean. I think in our experiments where you don't produce, you know, scary stimuli or so that the animal doesn't do this like big J turns or the sort of, so essentially it has this pretty, you know, moderate turning bars.
You were asking about the gaze though, right? Can you
track the gaze or the gaze?
Can you track the gaze in a
really
swimming animal?
No. So we've got some data from fine angles, and what happens is in free swim animals, you still see these sort of things, but the animals tend to spend a lot of time with the gaze going straight. So I think what happens is that when you do that and you turn, I think there's some sort of okay, and so the eye is gonna go back up, and then they're gonna turn again and go back up. So I think the fact that the distribution is like that is specific to the fact that the animal. Even if it tried to turn, it doesn't have the motion that brings the eyes back. Okay, so anyway, we're gonna make the assumption and the bet that the eyes direction, the gaze direction, gives us a proxy for the motor state. And so now what we can do is try to see if we can actually modulate that, right? So we take the same fish, we look at the eyes, and now we shine light on one side of the petri dish, and we look at the distribution of the right versus left. And what we saw is that okay, if the light is uniform, you get that. Now if I put more light on the left, then the animal is going to spend more time looking to the left. So you can actually bias this left-right distribution by showing light on either side of the fish, which is consistent with what we expected. So we ran another experiments using whole field illumination. So in that case, we do a little bit the same thing as I showed you before. We change the light intensity just depending on the gaze. If the animal looked to the left, I turn off the light. If it looked to the right, I turn up the light, right? And so we saw a little bit also of this change, which means that the animals tend to look longer to the right, even though it doesn't have any special information at any time. So it seems that the gaze dynamics is modulated by the light in a way that's consistent with what you would expect for phototaxy, assuming that this gaze is actually a predictor of the tailboot directions. Okay, now because of that, the first thing we say, okay, let's look at all the activity of the in the brain that's correlated with the gaze direction. So you take a fish, you put it in the light sheet microscope, you remove a little bit of the agarose so the eyes can go back and forth, and then you just record all you can record and correlate. So in that case, the blue colors means activity when the eyes go to the right, and the red colors means activity when the gaze goes to the left. So we suspect that among all these neurons, among all these populations, there should be the one population that actually control left and right. Okay, so
what happens when you put both lights on at the same time?
I'll show you that later in the talk. So in terms of analysis, so you have this fish here, you take a camera to look at the eyes, then you record all the band, and then you do some correlation, you do some regression between the signal of individual voxels and the eye tracking, and you get that. In that case, we discriminated between the position, so neurons that correlates with the actual gaze, and neurons that correlate with the velocity, which means the derivative of the gaze. So neurons that are going to spike only when the gaze change and then go down to zero. So we found different regions. Some of them were known. They've been studied before us, in particular this region here in the hindbrain, the RAMOMER 4 and 5. These are supposed to be the burst neurons, so the neurons that actually trigger the motor activity that's going to change. So these neurons tend to respond only when the gaze shift, and so depending on the side, they're going to respond to gaze going from left to right or right to left. Here, there's a very interesting region that's been studied a lot by many groups because it's supposed to be the velocity position neural integrators. So these neurons are supposed to integrate the activity from the burst neurons and do some sort of mathematical integration. So you have a direct of activity and they go up and they stay. And then they drive the motor neurons in order to maintain the gaze fixed at a certain position. So there's been a lot of interest in that because it's like a minimal motor for neural integration. Okay, and then we found out that these clusters here, which have not been described as participating in this gaze dynamics, were also active and have essentially a correlation with the gaze. And you can see here the blue and left of these clusters. So we wondered, but then we remember that in one paper that was published by the RN group a little while ago, and was shown here, this same region has been shown to display oscillatory activity even when the animal is paralyzed and completely covered with agarose. In other words, in this case, and we reproduce that here, the animal cannot move its eyes, so there's no movement of the eyes. But if you look at the activity of these two regions here, they show these very nice antiphasic oscillations. In other words, they oscillate with the gaze, right, as I've shown you before. But even if the animal cannot move its eyes, it keeps having this antiphasic oscillation. And if you look at the dynamic of this oscillation, so what is the typical period here, you get something of the order of 20 seconds, which is 2 times 10 seconds, as you may have guessed. So that pretty much corresponds to the period between going to left and right in the gaze. In other words, you maintain the same pattern of oscillation even in the absence of activity of the gaze. But you see that there's a little bit, but not much signals in the rest of the brain. So we suspect that maybe that's the right secret to look at, because that might be the secret that actually control this spontaneous oscillation. So we tried to nail that, and we went to Claire's lab to do optogenetics. And what we tried to do here is to see if we could control, using channel rhodopsin, the left and right dynamics of the gaze. And then so we alternate activation to the left, to the right, and so you can drive the eyes. And so, of course, and that has been shown before, it was published before, the fact that if you hit the burst cells, you do have a clear response here. But even if you apply the same sort of alternative stimulation in this region of the brain, which I'm going to call the hindbrain oscillator in the rest of this talk, I got a nice response. So it's not a definitive proof, but it's, again, an indication that this region could be controlling the gaze oscillation. So just to the idea that we propose is that the HBO is some sort of self-oscillating circuit that control the burst cells and essentially prohibit the movement of the gaze and the tail beat to a certain direction. We have indication that this could be actually efferent copy coming from the burst cells to the HBO, but I'm not going to talk about that. And in fact, as we were doing these experiments, Dune et al., since collaboration between Florian Gert and Misha Arends, showed that they could actually show that the activity of the HBO also correlates with the left and right turning bonds, which makes sense because of this strong correlation between the two. So we think we may have here in these circuits the common circuit that control the boats and ice orientation, and so that could be actually the circuit that control this left and right motor state of the fish. So if that's true, we should be able to modulate the dynamic of these circuits with light. And so we run these experiments with a two-photon laser, light sheet two-photon laser. And what we're going to do is we're going to turn on blue light, whatever, light to the right or to the left, and record at the same time the activity of the hindbrain oscillator. And so this is the pattern that we have average over seven fish of the gaze-tuned neurons here. And this is the pattern of activity that you have in response to left and right. So right is in blue and left is in red, of the left-right visual response. And so you see there's a strong similarity between the two. Another way to see that is to extract this hindbrain oscillator based on the oscillation, and then to look at the average response of each of these two left and right clusters to the alternation of left-light, right-light, left-light, right-light. And you can see that we can completely untrain the system. So if we put light if we turn off the light and to the right, we activate the right HBO. If we turn on the light to the left, we activate the left HBO. And this is shown in average of all the different oscillatory pairs.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
If you try to get as uniform illumination as possible, do you actually get symmetry breaking on its own? Or?
Yeah, so that's my next slide. And So what happens if you emit the two at the same time? This is like send a flash, uniform flash, and look, for instance, at the left HBO. So the first time we saw that, we were a little bit confused because it seemed that sometimes it seemed to respond pretty nicely here, and sometimes there is no response, and even maybe a decay of the activity. But now if I show you the right HBO, it seems to completely fill the gap. So if you do just a trial average, you see that both the two HBO respond to this uniform light flash, but they do it in such a way that's still very, very uncorrelated, right? Okay, so that was a little bit confusing, and I think maybe it shows how important it might be sometimes to record the two at the same time. Because if you only add the information here, it would be hard to say anything. So in fact, it seems that there's some sort of competition between the fact that they respond to light, but they also strongly inhibit each other. So we tried to understand that, and to do that, what we did is we took the difference between these two signals, and so this gives you something that looks like a sinusoid. in the first approximation. And now from this sinusoid, we can use the Hilbert transform to extract a phase. So what we extract is the equivalent of where we are in the cycle. So at each time step, right here, you can extract where we are in this oscillatory cycle. And now what we did is we plot the response of each of the two HBO, depending on the phase of the oscillation at which the flash was delivered. So you let this thing oscillate, and then you shine light. And so when you shine light, you're somewhere in the cycle, right? And so depending on where you are, you can activate either the left or the right. In other words, you make sense of this apparent randomness of the response by looking at the phase. And something that we found interesting is that if you look at that, this phase corresponds to the fact that the animal is looking to the left. And so it's like putting light to an animal that looks to the left seems to reinforce the leftward motor state. So that seemed at that time consistent with the experiments that I showed you where we turn on the light when the animal looked to the left and turn it off when it looked to the right. It seems to be a way to reinforce the direction of the light that is coming from.
These oscillations are at 10 seconds.
Yeah, so you're right. So we actually, yeah, so that makes this thing even more prominent. And so we tried changing that, and what you see is that if you apply this this stimuli within a period that's close to the spontaneous period, you have this nice entrainment of the oscillation. Now, if you go twice faster, you can have this period doubling. So it's something that's very classical in this oscillatory system in which you have a phase-dependent response. So we see that. I don't think that has any physical sense, but it's reinforcing this idea that you have this phase response.
But George, couldn't it be related to the internal frequency of spontaneous belt that you were saying is 10 seconds every 10 seconds in the...
Yeah, I think that, yeah.
But then, did you try to look in the Freudian swimming, like in the data set that were published by these two groups, whether they have activation at higher frequency there, or it's impossible, it's not going out?
But I mean, it's still of the order of 10 seconds. Like, the animal turn to the left for 5-6 bouts, and then to the right 5-6 bouts. So that's going to the left, going to the right. This alternation, even in free swimming, is still of the order of 10 seconds. Honestly, I haven't seen in this data anything that's good enough to extract this other information.
So it's still very slow when they're free swimming. They actually integrate on like long time scale, right? Even though they can modulate the interval to swim much more often, they will continue to integrate on such long time scale.
So the fact that they do it 5-6 bouts doesn't mean they integrate for 5-6 bouts. That's the thing of the first order autoregressive, that they only have to remember the last one, and if they make a decision, 80% I'm going to do like the last one, 80% like the last one, that's going to produce this 10 seconds oscillation. So you don't need to have a 10 second memory to produce 10 second self oscillation.
But I mean, you think that the 10 second slow oscillation is constant independent of the fact that the animal is free swimming compared to.
I think so. I think 10 seconds is pretty close to this free swimming alternation between left and right. So I think but it's the same order of magnitude for sure. Like it's a few seconds, it's less than a minute, and it's more than 5 seconds. So I think it's consistent. I don't know. Yeah.
Do you have a correlation between the amplitude of a turn and the deflection of the eye? Like if they really point the eye much more on one side, and they tend to turn more on that side with like the magnitude. So could you? So then, like, make sense of your stereo
results
just based on how much.
The amplitude, the saccades tend to really bring the eyes to the maximum that's possible, right? So what happens is that, so it's there, and then if it's saccades, it's going to go all the way, and then you're going to slowly drift a little bit, and then it goes all the way and slowly drift. And when you have a tailboat in between saccades, what happens is in general, there's another saccade in the same direction. So the eyes are going this way, drift a little bit this way, drift a little bit this way. That I'm talking about the the animal that are tethered. If they're not tethered, what happens is they go like that, and then they turn, and the eyes gets back in, and then they turn, and the eyes. So they do more like large amplitude saccades, and then large amplitude saccades in the other directions.
Okay,
but you can't really, there's no graduation in the amplitude of the cycads, right? Unlike the amplitude of the tailbones. So essentially when the cycad to the left, the cycad to, you know, the largest mechanically accessible direction.
Yeah, but since you have this untrained, maybe you miss something. There's a way to package the fish as some form of control that would be associated with like the movement of the eye that may be very fast, or maybe that's happening during the run itself. Like during the run bout, like you have some change in the eye orientation. I don't know if you
We don't have data that's resolved enough to follow the cycads during a free swimming animal. Some of the groups have that, so I think we should definitely try to get and extract this data. For now, we haven't extensively studied that.
Are you computing the phase after smoothing out the temporal data shown there? Does that phase computation include all of the high frequency and secondary bumps I see in that?
The phase is computed directly from the signal. The signal is smoothed out by the calcium reporter itself, and by the really low frequency of acquisition.
So, like in the third cycle, it'll go to 0, 180 a number of times.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the best we can do, but you're right. It's hard to really extract a phase from a signal that's oscillatory, but it has a lot of noise. So the question about the fact that we have this entrainment is an indirect way, but maybe more convincing way that you have this phase response, because that really need that to produce this this plateau of entrainment that we observed. Okay, so you can actually try to modelize that. So we used a very simple RET model in which you look at the evolution of the firing rate of these two system, and we put what we expect to create this oscillation, which is self excitation and cross inhibition, and then we compute some sort of input from the visual system that we feed to our data. So the hypothesis to fix the parameters are that we want to have this self-sustained oscillation, and we want to have it with the right time scale, right? So that's going to fix so you can produce numerically these oscillations with a time scale that of the order of 20 seconds inferior. And now when you do that and you look at of course, so if you present light to the right, light to the left, you can, you know, just because you plugged it this way, it's easy. But no, the funny thing is if you show light to both eyes at the same time, so if you put a symmetric input, you have the same sort of phase dependent response that's really simply produced by this the structure of this oscillator. So it doesn't take a lot of computation to actually get that, right? If you have that and you if you force the two systems at the same time, one of them is going to win, depending on what is the state of the system at which you deliver the stimulus. Okay, so I don't know what variable it is, but then we can of course try to compute a numerical model of the fish in which we produce this oscillation, and we have a simple rule, which is whenever the left FBO is up, the animal is going to turn to the left every 1 second. Whenever the right FBO is up, the animal is going to turn to the right. And we put a source here. We infer some sort of dependent on the source direction, on the intensity reaching each eye. So there's a lot of guessing in this thing, but I mean, pretty easily you get something like that. So I think the message here is essentially to get this sort of distribution of orientation towards the source, you need very, very simple network. You just need one oscillator and input from both eyes. And in a way, that is enough to reproduce quite a lot of the sort of observation that we've made. There's probably many, many more complicated things, but the very minimal models and model actually are already, you know, reproduce quite a lot of our data. Okay, so I think it's a good time for me to stop. So I'm gonna just conclude here, showing. So I try to show you that photoxin in zebrafish larva combines both clino and tropotaxi strategies, and they seem to act really in parallel, and they act on different parameters of the navigation. We use the gaze orientation as a proxy for the right-left model states because it's in a way easier than looking at the tail box because it has this very nice consistent left and right dynamics. So we use whole brain latching imaging to map both the sensory motor sensory and motor related networks. So this is the response to this is the correlation with the gaze. This is the secret that shows this antiphasic association, and this is the response to the light. So by comparing the three, you can sort of infer which part of the circuit might actually be involved in this sensory motor computation. So we identify this sort of CPG-like circuit that we think might control saccades and, of course, the left-right tailboats. And we can, of course, visually bias this circuit by left-right oscillation.
Before you go, yeah. Just two questions. So when the fish, like when they do a recapture with a forward sweep, yeah. They would like converge the eyes. Did you ever look what they were, you know, what was happening there when they do eye convergence?
Yeah, no, because these are really rare events. I think if you don't, we saw a few of these events. And so there's no way we're going to do a statistic on that. And, I mean, we can see them, but I mean,
if you put them with paramecia, they would do
yeah.
It, right?
So you have to, so you have to force this behavior. So what you suggest is to see what happened. But I mean, people have, yeah, this is like a.
I mean, they haven't imaged this region, right? Because it's like different from this oscillation left, right? Then, like, what do you expect to happen when the fish does eye convergence? Then? Because they don't control the two eyes the same way. If you, like what we've done is place the fish with a single paramecia in the agar, and when the paramecia gets close, they really do the eye convergence.
Yeah, I think somehow the visual system should take over on this spontaneous oscillation and make sure that the animal doesn't saccade to the left at the point where it's trying to get the so yeah, there must be some sort of secret that needs to take control of the eyes movement in this precise task.
And the second question is in the juvenile. So everything was in the larva, right?
Yeah.
In the juvenile, they have the opposite behavior,
yeah.
Right? That they're avoiding the light. So how do you think it changes?
No idea. No, it's really. I mean, I think that would be really interesting to if we could, you know. Go forward and see, because yeah, it's a complete inversion.
You can image at 1 month, right?
I can't.
Emre Yaksin is imaging at 1 month.
Yeah, I don't know if he has access to every, yeah, that would be, and yeah, no, that would be definitely an interesting question, but we really don't have the technology right now to do that. But yeah, that's a big question. Okay, so just let me conclude. Just saying that, you know, a lot of the work I showed you was done by Sofia Karpenko, who was here the last 3 weeks, and unfortunately she left yesterday, and Sebastian Wolf, and these are all the different people who participated in the lab. I'm very thankful to Clavia for the optogenetic experiments. Herman Soubré is the one person who introduced me to this model and helped me starting on this very exciting subject. A lot of the work that I've shown you, the neural model of sensory motor computation was done by Rémi Monasson with Alexis Dubreuil. The development of the two-photon light sheet was possible thanks to the help of these guys, and Florian gave us many lines. Thank you very much for your attention.
kind of meander to
So when the animal, I mean, it never, it always do some at least half of the turns are forward, but it can be less than that. You never turn less than the situation where the light is emotional. That's one of the results, right? So I think there is a competition between exploration, and the animal wants to explore, and the fact that the animal wants to go to the light. So it doesn't completely turn off the wish it has to explore. It just biased toward the light source in a certain way. And also, now we're trying to look at semotaxis. Actually, this same oscillator responds to heat and cold. So I think the animal, my vision is that the animal explore, and at each time step, it integrates information, thermal, visual, different information, and based on that, it's going to make the next swim bout is going to be biased, but not in a deterministic way ever. So that makes these experiments a little difficult because you need a lot of statistics to see that because it's just a bias. In a way, it's also interesting the at the neural level, the interaction between the spontaneous activity of the brain that control spontaneous navigation, and how this can be biased in a statistic way by the sensory inputs.
So when you look at this HPO area, see many neurons, right? How many neurons are there in this?
In this circuit?
Yeah.
It's typically like 300 on each side, 300 neurons.
Like, is there any understanding of what goes on inside the circuit?
Yeah, so this Misha Arends looking at this circuit too. So we know that you see there's like four stripes, two on each side. So two of the stripes are inhibitory, and two of the stripes are excitatory. So it seems consistent with the idea of this cross inhibition and self excitation. So, but we don't have an homolog of this circuit. That would be really interesting to see if that exists in other vertebrates. And yeah, we don't know much more about the circuitry that's behind the system.
Many other fish species can decouple their eye movements, you know, adult or juvenile fish can do that.
What do you mean decoupled?
They can move left right eyes independently of each other.
Yeah, so that's what Claire was referring to. At the larva stage, there is this
convergence.
Yeah.
Like you can look, you know, one eye here, just look with the other eye, and then vice versa.
Okay. Do you know that, Claire?
No, I think you've been looking at more fish at the adult stage area.
Yeah. Yeah, we should definitely know more about the adult stage, unfortunately. Yeah, I don't think there's been much work. Like on goldfish, I've seen that on goldfish. I don't know about zebrafish.
Maybe Gonzalo,
I guess. I don't know. I've always seen them a couple of times. I don't know.
Okay.
I haven't looked in detail.
Is there any indication why stochastic strategy is beneficial for the fish as compared to some possible deterministic strategy?
Okay. The question is, what is efficient strategy? If you want to go to the source, then you want to be deterministic, right? And the question is, what exactly do you want to do? What is the best strategy? And I think the best strategy is not to go to the first source that you see and stay there. I suspect, because otherwise I think the system would be developed to do so. So I think the right strategy is to explore, but prioritize some region of the environment that where the light is better, where the heat is correct. So we don't know what is the best strategy. We just, you know, see what the animal does, and we expect that it does as best as it can.
The first movie where you show the free flight looks like
free swimming.
Free swimming. Air in the water. Sorry. So when they initially you see phototaxis to the light source.
Yeah.
But then they don't stay there. Actually, they go away.
Exactly.
So they they at least explore.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it comes back. But my question is, in water, I imagine the light gradient is up and down. So right, so light above. So some fish, phototaxis will make them go toward the water surface. So what are the advantage for them to search light spots, as they go around? So maybe to see if they're a predator or not. Sometimes they avoid it because they are being prey.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, we don't know exactly, and as Claire mentioned, it turns the other way around. They become photophobic later. So we can make bets. The fact that they eat animals like Paramecia, which are phototactic, so you go where your preys have more chance to go. The fact that they go up and down, this is something we didn't look like. The animal can only go 2D, but we can imagine that there must be shadows. So there must be like a 2D pattern of and 2D gradients of luminosity. That's probably true.
And 2D,
you mean in the pond or wherever they are, there must be maybe I don't know some shadows. Branches, something where there's shadows, something where there's more light, and so the animal navigate around that and tends to stay where there's more light and shadow. Yeah, exactly.
I might be wrong, but I had the impression that you had a second peak in the probability 180 degrees. Is that correct? So you had the highest peak at the source. I had the impression that your model had, if you go back, the blue distribution, that one?
No, this is just, this is the, like,
so the minus 180.
Yeah, that's 180, minus 180, so this point could be here. That would be better too, actually. We should have just shifted that to the...
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Do you know whether the strategy that you've outlined generalizes the situations in which the light was patchy? You have very simple situations, right? It was basically one gradient.
Yeah.
And so, as you're describing, I don't know much about where these animals live, but it sounds like the reason they're doing this is to find things. They're in a pond, right? So, and you say there's shadows.
Yeah.
So if I create a spatially complex environment, do they just do this? And if the time they spend running straight is wider than the width of the shadows, then they just
That was exactly the sort of thing that I would be interested in. So the idea is to say, okay, if we had a perfect description of this short-term response, then we could do some sort of Fokker-Planck equation, and for any distribution of light, we would have an idea of how the animal would distribute. And then maybe that corresponds to this sort of thing, where you want to go to the light, but you don't want to be stuck in like one spot. Maybe you have more light here, it looks like a diffusion process with some drift, right? And maybe by adjusting this parameter, maybe that's very well adapted to the distribution of light. The thing is, we don't know much about that, about the natural distribution.
They live in very murky waters in the rivers of Asia, so there's not a whole lot of light. So it's actually a bit surprising. For example, in India, they live in murky waters where there's dirty waters where there's hardly any light.
There's enough light for them to see, right? And they respond to very small gradients. It's.
But anyway, this is speculation.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that this. I think we could try. At least we could try that externally. We could distribute a certain pattern of light, and then throw a bunch of animals and see how many of them gather here, how many of them gather here, and if we can understand that based on these very simple rules, right? And then we can always speculate to the fact that these rules are adapted so that they make the best of the sort of statistics of light distribution that they find in real life. But that's going to be a big step because we need to go in the field.
So going back to the brain absence, I think it's really neat because in the egg when they are just embryos, they have an opsin in the spinal cord that's doing the opposite, where every time there is light, they stop moving. So we think that's so that they don't get eaten or seen by moving in their egg. And they stop expressing it at the larval stage. So until 2 days, they are like really, really sensitive to light, and every time there is bright light, they stop contracting. And then after that, they don't respond to blue light anymore. But that would be neat to check if the brain opsin might be involved in this
response. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.